Hello everyone and welcome to this webinar today. I'm Frances Seeley from MPhil Climate Action Forum and from Global Net 21, which is a national and international organisation as well. And in the Climate Action Forum, we've been talking a great deal about how we could tackle waste as a way of looking at and addressing the climate crisis that we're facing. And one way of doing that is to adopt the principles of what is called the circular economy. And we've got Rembrandt Coppola with us today, who is a great advocate of the circular economy. And we're going to talk to him about that today, which is great. So welcome to this webinar, Rembrandt. It's good to have you here today. Maybe we could start, if you could tell us just a little bit, very briefly, something about yourself and your background.
Yes, so I'm originally Dutch, which the name kind of gives away. And I've been in the UK for 10 years now, and I used to work in the energy field. So I used to be on the consulting and modeling side. I worked briefly for a company that develops solar energy solutions. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided I want to switch and I want to look really at how can we get much better in society at not wasting as much of our stuff. Today I work for a company called Ecowise, and we work with some of the councils in England in projects. They also work with companies around how to reduce waste, how to recycle more, how to improve repair and reuse, but really from a more like organizational, how do we move this forward as an organization? What actions can we take? What infrastructure do we need in terms of processing and these type of things? And next to that, next to my work, I'm active as I call it a climate activist in a broader sense of the term, but really on this topic around the intersection between the stuff we use and the waste that it ends up and where it currently ends up in incineration, which releases a lot of CO2 emissions. So that gives a bit of a background about myself, and I live in Hackney at the moment.
Okay, so that takes us on quite nicely to the idea of the circular economy, which you are a great advocate of. I mean, just briefly again, can you tell us what you mean by a circular economy?
Yeah, so this comes in response to the idea of a linear economy, or what I think it's coined in the United States, take, make, dispose. I always get a bit confused the order, but like taking things from the ground, mining, extracting, or from, say, a forest, logging, or from a drilling platform, if you extract oil. So it's the taking. And then that goes into some kind of process to make something, whether it's a piece of furniture, whether it's a chemical, like that's turned into paint. And then after it's at the end of the use, we just dispose of it. So that's linear. It's a process and you repeat it over time and you have to take new stuff. And the response to that, the idea is to have a circular economy where you try to reduce the stuff you need. So you do the same with less and you try to make everything into loops. So you improve recycling so that where you still at something is at the end of its life, your piece of furniture, you no longer landfill it or burn it, but you maybe chip all the wood if it's a wooden piece of furniture and you use that wood for a wooden board that you then use in say at for your walls or for some other construction project.
So it's take, make, and reuse, which is the circular economy.
Yeah.
Now, I know you're an opponent of the Edmonton incinerator. Is that partly, I'm sure there are other reasons as well, but is that partly because it is not a part of the circular economy?
I think part of it you could see is that it's not fit in the kind of way that if you look at the whole project, it doesn't fit with the ambition to move away from having waste at all. So the way that I see the project and the way that the objectives around the project and some of the rhetoric of some of the proponents of the project is that there is no way we will have waste forever. And that is something that is a fundamental problem around the project, is we really need to look at what is the infrastructure that can work with phasing out waste altogether. And this seems a bit utopian, maybe, for someone who's never thought about this in a great deal of depth. But in principle, in nature, there is no waste. There is no landfill, there is no incineration. There is no piles of garbage. Things are eaten up by other organisms, and they're broken down, and then they become nutrients. And this can be the same for almost everything, and at some point, everything that we produce. So everything in principle, we could move forward with making everything recyclable and with making much more do with reuse. And that's the trajectory where we need to be. And there are countries that have this as a target. And the primary example of this is Wales. Wales has a policy target by 2050 to make everything recyclable and to make as much as possible reusable and repairable. And they are 100% recycling, and they are already now at close to 70% recycling of everything.
I mean, in Enfield, where I live and many of us live, I mean, it has one of the lowest recycling rates in London. And I know you talk about Wales and you talk about targets, but you believe that it is possible, don't you, to have a target that where we can, by the mid-30s get to 30%, not mid-30s, but very soon, over 30%. We can reach 65% by 2030. 85% by 2040 and zero by 2050. Now, you talk about being idealistic. Is that idealistic?
I think it depends on, it's idealistic if we don't together make plans to do it. So what I mean with that is something I've learned is that, for example, in England, this is not just London, but in London, this is much exacerbated, is the majority of flats do not, and people living in flats, do not have access to dry recycling bins or food waste recycling bins. They're not offered as a service. So they don't have bin houses where they can bring their recycling, which means that there's a lot of, the reverse of that is there's a lot of potential for improvement there. There's only in the last few years, it seems that councils are really starting to put efforts into giving access to recycling infrastructure for everyone. So what does that mean? If a large portion of your population lives in estates and flats and they don't have access to recycling, if you give them access, you can increase the recycling rates with enough effort. Of course, there are always what they call educational aspects. People need to sort the metals and the plastics and the glass and the food waste and so on. That takes time to learn about these things. And also it's quite complicated the way it's done now in terms of how it's approached in my perspective. But there are improvements that are possible there that are quite easy to do.
But that takes time, as you said. And in the interim period, we have to deal with the waste we've got. So what's the solution in the short term? Is it incineration? Because the NLWA might say that that is a circular economy. They have district heating to community houses and so on, and that it's dealing with a short-term problem. Is that a reasonable argument, or is that one that you would contest?
I think the question is, yes, it takes time, but it shouldn't take more than 5 years to give everyone access to recycling. Right. So what are the timeframes we're talking about? And to then have more education, awareness campaigns, community efforts. So I think there are things that can be done in a reasonable amount of time frame within this 2030 time frame. Then your question asking, yes, there will be for the foreseeable future, meaning the next 10, 15 years, there will be a portion of waste left over that is not recycled. And then we're not even talking about reuse. So there are starting to be councils in England that have reuse targets. 5% of everything should be going to reuse loops, or 10%, meaning furniture we use. And we don't capture this information. We don't know actually, for example, we don't know for who's listening, how many people like actually give their clothing or receive their clothing from family members or friends. This data doesn't exist. We have no idea. And it might be a very large portion already. So there is a lot of circular economy already, but we don't really know what its impact is also locally for people. I'm not trying to avoid the question, Francis. No, no. So there will be a portion of waste left over. There are then two options. One is to incinerate this elsewhere. I think landfilling is out of the question for most of the waste, or to build a smaller incinerator. So those are the two options to move forward with. In my perspective, I see that there are a lot of existing incinerators. There's a lot of new ones being built, and I don't see the point of overbuilding incineration capacity. But I don't comment from it from a perspective that London needs to be fully self-sufficient, for example, these kind of ideas. So this to me that if you have excess capacity already, and you have the infrastructure already, or it's being built, then use it elsewhere. But that's another, I think, discussion. And those come back to also kind of ethical or more moral points of view.
But you also talk about having a plan to move to where you want to be, not just have a general idea, but to have a sort of step-by-step plan. And you talked about having a four-point plan, I believe, and maybe we could talk about that. And the first is setting up a £10 million fund per year for waste prevention, reuse, recycling, improvement.
Yeah.
How would that work?
Unfortunately, everything requires some investment to get things going. But the good thing about the circular economy is also that it leads to jobs, a local economy, and recycling. So aluminium is worth quite a lot of value. Yeah? It's £800 per ton. Good quality paper is worth quite a bit. But some things are not, like food and garden waste is kind of budget neutral. It doesn't deliver economic value to the councils directly, but it doesn't cost them as if it's done as well, if that makes sense. So there are not enough revenues at the moment, and the councils need to decide whether if they really want to reach these targets, they need to invest. And they need to invest significantly more than they're currently doing. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do outreach. If we're talking about the flats, for example. You need to do outreach to people, and you need to do doorstepping and door knocking, and you need to do campaigns, and you need to have funding available for that. So the amount that's currently invested in that in North London is probably somewhere around 300,000, 400,000 per year in terms of additional campaigns efforts. I'm not talking about the total, but that's something like that. And it probably needs to be 15, 20 times more to be able to reach the targets. This is an estimate. Where could that come from? And this is, there's some legislative changes that will make budget available. And this is a bit technical, but the government at the moment is putting in place a new system to make brand owners pay. Yeah, so if you think of your favorite brand or your three favorite brands, maybe you have some, maybe you hate brands. Those are other people, but some people, I like my sports shoe brands. I won't tell which ones because that's, they will have to pay for packaging, for the packaging disposal. This is going to make money available to councils, and the councils could use that money that's going to become available by 2024 to advance recycling, reuse, repair. And that will be in that order of magnitude. It will actually be more than 10 million in North London. So there's opportunities for additional funds. So that's the first part. And then the question is, what are you going to do with that? Well, you could look at collecting nappies, for example. And nappies is 6% of what's burned is nappies. Yeah, that's the plastics and paper with organic waste from the babies. You could collect them and you can recycle them. You could think about making sure everyone in the flats have access and campaigns. You could pre-sort the plastics from the residual waste and try to recycle these.
That's another thing that was your
second
point,
thing in the
wasn't
plan.
It? You're talking about 700,000 ton mixed waste sorting plastics and recycling
yeah.
facility at Eco Park. Now, that sorting isn't done by Enfield. It isn't done by a lot of people, is it? But you're talking about having that as being essential.
Yeah, so we have a certain things that we can improve on the on making sure that it's collected and recycled. We could have reused. I think there needs to be, for a lot of people, supporting social enterprises that do things with the waste, crafts, tradespeople. I think these are very important to support them, and that's also in this fund. And then the second part is, what do you do with the leftover bit that is doesn't go into recycling or reuse streams? And one of the things for the climate that we really should be looking at is, in my view, is we should not be burning plastics. And yeah.
Okay, so I mean, and clearly that's what we're doing a great deal of at the moment, and that's a real problem. You also talk about the importance of education, enhancing education, RRPs, I think they're called, recycling plans, council recycling plans. Why do we need that education? Where do we need it to go to?
So I don't know if you've looked at your shopping basket recently, but you probably can imagine, and also anyone's listening, it's a bit mad the amount of different materials that we get, and then we're supposed to ask to say, okay, this one goes into a green bag, that one goes into a black rubbish bag, and it's confusing. And so I think things need to be simplified. I think we're being asked to do too many different things. And there's also a bit of education that is needed to help people on how they should sort and what they should sort. So there's a bit of that. I used to live in a flat, and I had a neighbor, and she, in this case, had never heard of green bags. Yeah, so there are people, and they, because they've never been, they're not, we're very diverse in London, and they didn't know that there's such a thing. You can order recycling bags from the council. So there is some basic support, I think, is needed, and that's the education part.
That's the awareness you need to
create. Awareness, yeah awareness. And then there's collaboration. So I think we're talking a lot about education, but there's also collaboration, facilitation. So where social enterprises, for example, community composting. The best thing you can do for the climate is to compost your food waste and your garden waste, as opposed to transporting it to a facility somewhere else in England, with the additional transport costs, where it then gets composted. But the best thing is to do it in your, and you have a cyclical garden. That's one of the better things you can do.
But that
requires collaboration. So we need to have collaboration on community composting organizations and these type of efforts.
So is that, I mean, the composting idea and so on, is that a part of your fourth objective, which is to try and ensure that the remaining residual waste is disposed of in the most environmentally friendly way?
So the remaining residual waste, so that's really stuff that you can't compost or turn into biogas. So you have some leftover, at least in the interim, and you will have to decide what to do with it. And the only options for that are landfill and incineration, unfortunately. So that's the part of the story is we are too far we are not there yet. There will be, and so what do I mean with that? For example, textiles, all the garments that we use and we wear, and we don't really have good technology to take apart if it's multi-fabric. If it's just cotton, it's much easier to do something with it in terms of making new clothing out of it and taking the yarn. But if it's polyamide, which is a plastics kind of polyester fiber with cotton, with other things, it makes it difficult. So you have a left at the moment until we simplify kind of the clothing, or we have something that takes the fibers apart. They're working on this, they being a number of clothing companies. And that makes it possible to recycle those much easier. But at the moment, that's not happening. So the best route we have for the moment for clothing is reuse. And then at the end, once the clothing is worn out, what happens typically is it's incinerated, or in some cases, like for jeans, it can be turned into insulation material. This is what happens at very large scale, actually, in France, not in England. They collect tens of millions of jeans, and they turn it into insulation material for houses to keep the warmth in.
Yeah, you see, that's quite interesting, technological change. I mean, there are so many technological changes taking place now in this area that you get a feeling that the North London Waste Authority, local authorities, are not keeping up to it. They're not really knowing all the technological things that are happening. Do you get that feeling or understanding that that's not happening? They think incineration is the modern thing, but in a way, it's a technology that's fast becoming outdated, and it's being surpassed by other newer forms of technology.
I think that's a very astute observation, Francis. I think this is in general a huge challenge. It's the pace of change, and also it's the incentives or the way that the structures of the society is set up. Like, it would be great, this is a big problem in the circular economy, is that if we want to bring people who make things locally, and we want to foster that, and not just talking about big factories, but for example, glass blowing or making glass objects. Typically, everyone has little glass objects. I have one here. It's a little jar. It has a few things you hold in it. So you could make that locally from waste glass, but that needs to be supported. And this is a challenge also, I think, with the amount of investment needed, the roles that those organizations have. They don't see themselves as technologically innovators, nor do they see themselves as organizations that support the local social economy, and that support fostering social enterprises or companies. And the councils, some see themselves a bit like that, but it's not in the fabric of the organizations.
The technological changes, I think, are really interesting. I mean, for example, there are now, I gather, aerobic digestive waste plants. There's clean energy, district heating. There's technologies to recycle plastics and turn it into building materials, for example. I mean, all of these things are quite exciting to see happening. But I'm not entirely sure that councillors and everyone else is keeping up with that. You can't blame them, because it's really difficult. How do you get that information over to them so they understand there are alternatives?
It's a very good question, and it's a very hard question, I think. In my experience, the key... the question behind the question you're asking, what's the driver for change? And how can you accelerate good developments? And part of that is having examples. So if there was a really good functioning, well-marketed facility in the UK that takes plastics out of the black bags and does that successfully, I'm intentionally saying marketed here, which is like it's on the headline news, and it is almost like there's a visitor center. That helps a lot to have examples, because if there are existing examples, there's a certain need of proof for organizations like councils to take such things on board, because they're not in a position to take wagers with public money. Let's phrase it that way, to take that risk. And there are some facilities in the UK that do this, that take the PET bottles, for example, successfully out of those black bags and turn them into recycling, but they're not well marketed. There's one in Levenseat in Scotland that does that. But this is part of the problem as well. It's not really, and part of that is that it's not really an exciting thing. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to look at a bunch of black bags. I think from a journalistic perspective, we're going to look at the black bags and seeing what happens. it's not something that is part of that. So I think this is a big challenge, is you need really good examples. And a second challenge is you need to look beyond the local and beyond your borders. And what the example of France I mentioned, a lot of people in England will say on the jeans and take turn as insulation material, say, oh, it happens in France, not relevant. I'm not kidding. This is some of the comments I've received from councils, not on this specific topic, but from some councils. It doesn't happen in England because it's not relevant. And that isn't specific to England. This also, I come from the Netherlands. The Netherlands, they say, oh, it happens in Germany. It's not relevant. And this is the kind of, I think it's a bit of older style thinking, where we still didn't have a globalized world. And so I think this is part of what happens. And then another challenge is it's really complex. So it's not a simple thing. A councillor's job is not easy. The people who are in the waste recycling management teams, some councils are looking at circular economy teams, but that's very new in England. And they are not equipped necessarily to look at these things on an ongoing basis. And they should be in the waste authorities, in my view, but they're not sufficiently equipped to do that as well. So that's the question. Often it boils down to having a few individuals, so really trying to put this on the agenda and in different organizational bodies, in my experience. Maybe just a bit of a long answer.
Yeah, no,
it's some insight.
No, it's a good answer, and it's one of our biggest challenges to get people on board on this, and it is complex, and people do like to think that the best ideas are the ones they've created themselves, especially in local authorities. And so trying to get them to look beyond their borders is very difficult. I mean, we're talking about what statutory authorities can do, but individuals can make a difference in this as well, in the way they behave and in what they do. How important do you think individuals making a difference is, or does that just cloud the issues that we've got to confront the big players?
Yeah, so I'm not of the, call it the school of belief, or maybe you call it the idea. I'm not an advocate of that we should put responsibility on all individuals to change their behavior, and that will really lead to a big impact. What I think individuals can do is try to contribute to changing the system. And to initiatives that either locally change the system, either in a communal level. So I mentioned, for example, community composting. If people are interested in gardening and they are keen on this, this is something that there are increasing organizations now starting up in the UK. But it's just an example, right? Or to furniture rehabilitation, these kind of communal, more communal services. And I think this is really a key part of the circular economy, which used to happen. However, one of the tricky parts, and this is another topic for another day, is that the wages are too low to make these things work. And this relates to social injustices. To really have a circular economy based on reuse and to be able to, for people to afford things that require a lot of labor, because they do, wages are not high enough. I'll park that there, but I think that's a really key topic, that social justice and circular economy are actually really important both together.
But the idea of the circular economy, I mean, we talk about it very glibly, very often, and very easily, and it's become, you know, a jargon term lately. Yeah. But people don't really think about it because it very often means a sort of cultural mind change in your mindset, a cultural change, doesn't it? I mean, are you confident that we can shift culturally towards that mindset? We can do that cultural change that's necessary to make our economy circular rather than linear?
I think I believe in a few things. One is necessity is the mother of all invention. I think is a good phrase. The other is under pressure, everything becomes fluid and change will happen. And both from a climate change perspective, but also from a perspective of the availability of certain materials. I think this is not very often discussed, but if you have a mobile phone, the amount of metals it has, and those metals, not all of them will be available forever. in terms that become more costly to extract. So we will have problems, maybe not in the next 10 years, but in the next 30, 40, 50 years of availability of some of those metals. This is why there's a hub in the UK in our working research circular metals hub to look at metal circularity. And also there's a few of them funded by the UK government. So I think change will happen because people, more and more because people want to see the change in the future, but also because they see those threats coming. And I think that will be, that's very abstract maybe. And then there are some things that you know, there's a big shift in society. At the moment, it's still accepted that we buy things from very cheap from all over the world. And with people in extremely poor labor conditions, very extractive, very socially unjust, and that's the way that this system works. That is not how the future needs to be. The future can very well be that people get much more local production again, in terms of items that you use in the home. But what is required for that is that people need to be able to afford it, because at the moment, a lot of people, they can't afford it. Yeah, they can't afford locally repaired and made clothing. It's much more expensive. And so, part of that is the economic system. So, I think this is a longer discussion.
Yeah, so it is a longer discussion because, yeah. I mean, you're talking about, you know, the fear of what's happening, making people's minds change. Yeah. You're also talking, are you, I'm not sure, that positive disruptive technology can almost lead to positive disruptive politics as well. And that is a big discussion for another webinar, but in a way, that's partly what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes. So that there's it's like change happens in many directions. The key area is always to make the change that you want to see, make it the priority in politics. There's it's like the theory of priority streams, a councillor or a local politician or within a company. The decision makers, they have certain priorities and what's on their priority agenda. And making change in terms of climate change, environment, circular economy, reducing waste is not on the priority, then it's going to drop off. So that's part of it, which is, I think, where the climate emergency declarations have been really instrumental. It made this a priority agenda. And a lot of change has happened from that. And then there's disruptive positive changes that can happen. I think one really great change that's up and coming are called drop-in heat pumps for homes that are can replace directly gas boilers and have the same functionality. They're coming much better than the current generation heat pumps. That will see a huge wave of improvements in renewable energy in buildings. And those are positive disruptions, the same as we're seeing now with the electric car.
Okay, we've sort of come to the end of our 30 minutes now. It's gone very quickly, and I'm sure we would do other webinars and interviews in the future because you have so much to offer and advice to give, and that's really important. So thank you, because I think this has been a great introduction to the whole idea of the circular economy in relation to what's happening in local authorities, and especially around how we tackle waste, which, as you know, in North London has become a real, real hot topic. So, you know, thank you for joining us. And I know you're going to join us at a meeting fairly soon in a week's time. And it'd be great to have you there for other people to meet you. But I mean, this has been a great interview and a very, very interesting one as well. So thank you for doing it, Rembrandt. It's been great. And we'll end this interview now.